Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Adam Steinbaugh, Colette Vogel, and Mark Jaffe join me. We've got a full blotter of interesting topics for the show today, mostly exploring what's okay and what's not in 2015, including non-consensual pornography, trademarking Cecil the Lion, and allegedly infringing backbeats, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 315, recorded August 14th, 2015. RISA on demand. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay, period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions, be free. Go to braintreepayments.com/twill. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting and invoicing solution that can help your law firm and any small business save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/twill. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We have so many juicy topics to talk about today that I'm just so excited you're with us and so excited to get to them. But first, of course, I'm going to introduce our illustrious panel of guests. Welcome back to the show after a long break, a much too long break. Colette Vogel. Hello, Colette.
Hi, Denise. It's great to be back. Thank you.
Longtime listeners will remember Colette from many, many episodes of This Week in Law. But for those of you who have not yet met her, she is the co-founder and president of Without My Consent. She's also a senior attorney at Microsoft, but that is her day job, and she is not here to opine or otherwise speak on behalf of Microsoft in any way, shape, or form. And we're thrilled to have you on the show, Colette.
Great. Thank you. It'll be a fun day.
Also joining us is Adam Steinbaugh, who's here in Southern California, near to me in proximity, at any rate. He is a law school graduate and a journalist on technology law and free speech issues, and writes at Popat, which we were discussing before the show. A great blog if you haven't checked it out. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Thank you for having me. First time caller, I guess.
First time panelist. Yes, wonderful to have you. Also a first-time panelist who we're thrilled to have is Mark Jaffe, who's a lawyer for Tor Eklund. He advises startup companies and practices law in many of the areas that we frequently discuss on the show, including copyright, trademark, right of publicity kind of law, had a big case involving the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Many other tech-related subjects are within Mark's bailiwick. So nice to have you on the show.
Good morning, Denise. Thanks for having me.
Our very great pleasure. All right, we are going to start out talking about non-consensual pornography, which I think is a more accurate term going forward for what we traditionally, or many people traditionally, have called revenge porn. We're going to start out looking at the legal landscape around non-consensual pornography right now. Colette, it's more of a mouthful to say non-consensual pornography than revenge porn, but it's more accurate probably for what lawmakers and policymakers are trying to prevent and the harm that is happening to people when they have, in whatever ill-advised way, shared intimate photographs of themselves with another and then they have become public. Why is the revenge aspect not as prevalent as it might once have been?
Well, I don't know the prevalence of the reason why someone decides to engage in non-consensual pornography, if it's revenge or for money or for lulls or what their real purpose is. But I think the term revenge porn was first coined in the media because it does cover a segment of this problem, and it is kind of a catchy way to identify the problem. But the issue of non-consensual pornography, or another mouthful would be non-consensual distribution of intimate images.
yes.
It can take a lot of different forms. It can be someone who's hacked your computer, who you've never shared these images with in the first place. But it could be with somebody that you once trusted and decided to share this content with, and then they violate that trust after something happens and use it as a form of revenge. It can also be a Peeping Tom video that's taken. You know, there's a lot of ways these things can come up. Revenge porn is a catchy word that seems to stick well with the media, but it isn't a very good description of the real problem.
Right, and sextortion falls into this category too, where people are duped into providing photographs of themselves and then further duped into saying, well, if you pay me, I'll take them down. And they pay, and maybe the photos or videos come down and maybe they don't. So this is something that state lawmakers have been grappling with around the United States. We now have 24 states that have some form of law on the books criminalizing kinds of activities we're discussing, and they're doing it in different ways, as you might imagine, the states all having different takes on how to do this, and some of them doing it more clumsily than others. And now we have a federal revenge porn bill, or non-consensual pornography bill, expected to come our way from Congress next month. By September 9th is the target date now. From, is it Jackie Speier, Congressperson Jackie Speier from California? They're trying to take on the issue as well and bring some unity to the laws that are out there. Of course, as we were talking about on our last show, if folks listened in a different context, when the federal government legislates in an area, to the extent that state laws conflict with it, the federal law prevails. So that's how some unity would be brought here. As I mentioned, Adam, some states have done better than others in trying to legislate in this area. And the challenge is, obviously, there are harms and wrongs here that lawmakers want to prevent and victims they want to protect. But sometimes their drafting is, as I mentioned, a little clumsy or problematically broad. Can you tell us what happened in Arizona?
Well, Arizona is the perfect example of that, where the legislature kind of rushed together this bill and didn't really listen to criticism of it. And what they did is they didn't include much in the way of a requirement of showing an intent to harm or an exception for photos or material that might be newsworthy. So, for example, the famous Anthony Weiner sort of photos. And what happened was the ACLU, representing a number of bookstores and other publishers and other plaintiffs, filed a lawsuit in federal court there saying that this law is overbroad and we want it struck down. And the state of Arizona looked at it and said, you know what, it is pretty overbroad. We will agree to temporarily not enforce it while we redraft it. And while they were redrafting it, the legislative session ended and the state was forced to say, okay, we won't enforce this law until the next session or, you know, until we can pass a new one, and wound up paying the ACLU $200,000 in attorney's fees. So right now, Arizona technically has a law on the books, but nobody's going to enforce it.
Do you have a good guess as to what's going to happen, if it will get amended or maybe they just start over from square one?
There had been a proposed bill there, and I've lost track of how it stands or how it stood when the legislative session ended. So we will see if they introduce another one this upcoming term. And I suspect they probably will, but I have no inside knowledge on that. And I think that, you know, whatever they propose, I think the legislature will ultimately wind up passing it because revenge porn is, or not revenge porn, but involuntary porn or non-consensual pornography is such a compelling issue that it's difficult to vote against any sort of legislation on that.
And that's what I'm curious to ask Colette about to Colette. First of all, tell folks who are joining us who may not be familiar with your work a bit about Without My Consent and what its goals are.
Sure. Without My Consent is mostly about educating the public about the problem of online harassment. And one of the main area we've focused on in the 5 years or 4.5 years since we've existed is the issue of the use of images online without one's consent, which largely is this exact problem of revenge porn. What we have provided is some state law resources. We have published 5 states. We have many more that we're about to publish. And we do, we talk to companies when they ask for our advice on how to address these problems through their terms of use and their community standards. We also host events, usually in conjunction with a fundraiser, to get a panel of people together to talk about the issues and what we can do to help both victims and law enforcement and not trample on the First Amendment rights of the people using the internet. So we have a kind of a unique position. We don't do, you know, straight up lobbying. That's not our purpose. Our purpose is really mostly about education. And if I can just mention, we won a big grant recently, and we're very excited to be able to roll out a lot more content over the next year to 2 years, involving educational resources for law enforcement, judges, lawyers, advocates, and a lot of people. I think that'll be a really big piece of what we can offer coming up. So that's basically what we're doing. There's another organization I wouldn't mind mentioning called the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. And they do a lot of much more active, direct help for victims. They have a hotline and things like that, which is really fantastic. And they also have spent a lot of effort on educating legislatures and encouraging them to pass state laws, and have been a big part of why so many states have passed all these recent legislations. And the folks at CCRI include Marianne Franks, who's a law professor in Miami, who's helped draft some of these laws, including the federal legislation that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about her, and in fact, we're going to invite her on the show. I hope she can join us at some point in the future. But what I wanted to get your take on, now that you've sort of set the landscape for the various efforts that are in progress, is if you feel that double tracking things, having private companies take steps, and we're going to talk about some of those in a moment, on one front is a good idea, but also having laws in place at the state and federal level is also a good idea. And how do you feel that lawmakers are prepared to really grapple with these issues? And unlike the example we've seen in Arizona, make laws that make sense from both a speech and communication standpoint and a victim protection standpoint?
So it's complicated, but I think as an advocate for helping people who have faced this problem firsthand, it's been some time since I've worked directly with somebody to solve the problems, but in my earlier years of my practice, I did. And seeing how these issues really impact their lives, I mean, not just for a week or 2 weeks or 6 months or a year, but their lives will be changed forever because of how these things sometimes unfold and affect things like their employability and their security and their feeling like they can have a relationship with somebody again. Those are serious things that these victims end up having to deal with. And I am, because of that background, I'm very sympathetic to doing any reasonable things to help victims solve these problems. And if that means intermediaries taking a little more, making a little more effort and thinking of smart ways to encourage their communities to not allow non-consensual pornography on their services, I think that's great. If it's helping demote non-consensual pornography through search, I think that's great. If it's making smart legislative efforts to get at the things that prosecutors are not feeling comfortable bringing because they don't feel like they have a clean law in their hands, I'm for tweaking those criminal laws to make prosecutors more likely to bring these cases. They want to win cases, and they I think often, because the state laws are a little murky in some areas, don't want to be the test case and lose and not have the justice that they're trying to seek for the public and for the victim. But it's tricky. I have to admit, when we first did launch Without My Consent, it was the first two pieces of research that we conducted was all of the California state law. If you go under 50 State Project on the website, you'll see the states. And we have all the laws cataloged from California, and we did this several years ago. And I was sort of stunned at how many laws could potentially address a particular situation. And it made me pause and say, well, do we really need more laws, or should we just be enforcing the laws we have? And I think that's a valid question, and we need to talk about that when we think about where we're going to add new legislation. So with that, I think that kind of gives you my frame of mind.
Right.
Very pro-victim, but I want to be thoughtful about it. I don't want to, you know, have things like what happened in Arizona happen in other places.
And we should give some examples of what kinds of laws you're talking about. On the civil front, there are already causes of action for invasion of privacy, intentional infliction of emotional distress. On the criminal front, there might be laws that apply that involve identity theft. Hacking, as you mentioned, can be one of the ways that these pictures come into somebody's hands and then get made public. What other sorts of laws? I know we just had the California page up, but what else comes to mind?
There's breach of confidence. There's all the traditional privacy torts, false light. Those things can really be the right from a civil action side. They can be the right case. Defamation is often a potential claim, depending on what the perpetrator did. There's as you can see from what's on the screen, there are a number of laws, even in the family law area and restraining orders and criminal law. I mean, there's things that you can do that could be applicable to a particular fact pattern. So what we have on our website is kind of the broadest swath of things that we could think would potentially touch on these kinds of cases. And when you get a particular fact pattern, then you can kind of think about which ones are really make sense. Now, I don't want to overstate the value of having civil or even criminal laws in place, but the civil laws are only helpful if there's somebody who has the money to file a lawsuit and go after a perpetrator. And even then, you can win. You can win by default. You can win by actually winning the case, but you can't actually erase what's already been put out on the internet very easily. And it's really hard to rectify the harm once an image or a series of images have gone viral and are tagged with a person's name and make it kind of impossible for them to unring that bell. So part of what we want the civil laws to do is to hopefully deter some people, and the criminal laws can do that very well too if cases are brought. But I'm kind of a realist in having, you know, bringing a lawsuit isn't often the best thing for a victim to do right away. I mean, they have other self-help things that they might want to try before, if they can even afford to bring a lawsuit.
Right. And here's what Jackie Speier, the federal congresswoman who is trying to get the federal law through, that's going to be called. Let's see, I jotted it down.
Intimate Privacy Protection Act.
Yes, IPA. She says, our laws haven't yet, despite how many of them there are that might apply to these kinds of acts, our laws haven't yet caught up with this crime. If you're a celebrity, you can pay a high-priced lawyer to demand that websites take your picture down. But for an average person, the current system offers almost no recourse. We already punish the unauthorized disclosure of private information like medical records and financial identifiers. Why should personal images of one's naked body given in confidence be any different? Well, I can think of one reason why they might be different. And Colette and Adam and Mark, if you're still with us, I think we might be trying to get Mark back. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too. That sounds like a great article, a great argument. And yes, we're talking about personal, intimate details in all of those situations. But when we're talking about medical records and financial identifiers, we're talking about people who are fiduciaries under the law, who owe you heightened duties of care. And we're going to talk in a second here about the shifting social dynamics that might be contributing to this whole arena. But in this context, the people who have these photos might not be fiduciaries at all, might be people that you should be, you know, definitely on your guard with, people you barely know. Does that make a difference, Colette?
I certainly think fiduciaries have a separate set of obligations, but I think that the fact that someone has an image of you that is naked or whatever, they don't have, I mean, there's a lot of laws already that say they don't have a right to publish that image without your consent. And there are mm-hmm. exceptions, there are newsworthiness situations, and, you know, exceptions to that rule, but you have a privacy right as an individual to maintain certain aspects of your life as private. And mm-hmm. I feel like if we go into a direction where anybody can do anything, that's not a healthy place for anyone to be. We can talk about the specific things that people are sharing through various apps or, you know, texting, whether it's a good idea to do it or not. But ultimately, it's not the right of the person who receives an image to repurpose it however they want, unless they've been given that permission by the person.
Right. Well, yeah, let's unpack that a bit. Before we do, Adam, did you have any thoughts on does it make a difference whether you're sharing with your bank, your doctor, or your casual hookup?
I would just add that if it's a bank or your doctor or another fiduciary, they're going to mm-hmm. be on a greater level of notice as to what the law expects of them. Whereas your average boyfriend is not going to be trained on these sorts of aspects of the law. There's no boyfriend manual to dating and the law that they're going to get, you know, when they enter into a relationship. Now, is it common sense that you don't post your ex-girlfriend's photos on the internet? Yes. But I am concerned by imposing criminal liability on people who might not be of the same sort of notice that a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, so on and so forth, they might be.
And I
worry about giving prosecutors that much discretion.
There's an education curve, I think, on both sides of this equation. People are out there doing really dumb things by sharing these photos of themselves. And then, as you point out, Adam, the people who are the recipients might not have any idea what laws govern them about what they can do. Here's a stat for you from a study done by McAfee. 54% of U.S. adults participate in sexting, so more than half. And when you drill down to the 18 to 24-year-old age group, it goes up to 70% saying they've received such a message. So that actually dovetails really well with an article I read this last week called Tinder and the Dawn of the Dating Apocalypse in Vanity Fair. That you might think is only tangentially related to this problem. But as I read through it, I felt like, you know, we were seeing everything shift. That, you know, we've all talked about, oh, if you're going to share a photo of your ex in sort of a vindictive way. But as I read through this article and started to contemplate a world, it talks about Tinder and Happn and all the various dating apps that are out there, and this shift towards looking at casual encounters with people as one of the interviewees in the article says, the equivalent of having takeout food delivered. You know, it's that easy, it's that convenient, and it's that automated and sort of dehumanized. So I think, you know, as I read through this, I thought that it could aggravate this whole non-consensual pornography problem in two ways. Number one, it seems like there could be tons of pressure in the communities using these apps to arrange their social lives. to share these kinds of pictures. And if 70% are of the 18 to 24 year olds are already sharing these kinds of pictures, maybe this is just, you know, part of that scenario. But it seems like if you're competing to get dates with the person you've swiped right on, then part of that competition pressure might be, you know, revealing a bit more about yourself in an image kind of way. And secondly, this whole dynamic of automating the connections seems to take humanity out of the equation. And there seem to be a lot of just, you know, racking up notches on the belt or on the bedpost kind of attitude toward the people they were connecting with. And in that kind of environment, it would be no wonder that sharing pictures would be looked at as sort of, well, you know, she gave me this. What did she think? She didn't use Snapchat. Or he, you know, it doesn't have to be limited to the male-female kinds of relationships. Doesn't have to be, you know, I'm sure, and Colette, maybe you can speak to this a little bit, that these concerns are not just concerns of the straight community, that the LGBTQ community too has issues around this, particularly around bullying and intimidation, I would think. So against this backdrop of people in their teens and early 20s and 30s, just sort of the young single dynamic of the dating apps, I don't know how lawmakers grapple with this, because it's not the context that we're used to thinking of this issue in. Adam, let me get your thoughts on that first.
Well, I can't really speak to the social dynamics there, but I do kind of want to rebut the notion that it's stupid to send photos to a significant other. I think that, you know, if people are into that and that is helping them build a relationship, we should be encouraging that. And I think the question is, how do we use the law to protect that aspect of a relationship? I don't think that it's stupid to do that. And I think that our anger should be reserved for the people who are using someone's trust against them to get revenge or to hurt them. As for the social dynamics, I don't really know whether or not Tinder is going to increase the pressure on people to share photos with one another. I know in my brief use of Tinder, nobody asked me for a nude photo. So, again, nobody has asked outside of Tinder either. So I don't know what the dynamic there is.
All right, good. We haven't heard from Mark yet on these issues. I know we've been having some connectivity issues with you, Mark. I'm just wondering if you want to weigh in on any of this.
A couple of things. First of all, you mentioned the surveys of people use the sex things. I wouldn't trust any 17 to 24-year-old on what they say about how much they're sexting or doing anything else with sex. But one of the things you hadn't talked about, you've talked about some of the laws that are being passed and the legislation that are being passed, but we haven't talked much about third-party liability. I presume, based on your discussion of these bills and the laws, you're talking about the actual perpetrators, the people who are sharing the photos and the people who post them online. There's a lot in getting some kind of liability or some type of responsibility or obligation to third-party providers, the websites that host the images and other internet service providers, is challenging. I could expand on that, but I don't know if you had anything to say about that. Right now, many of the challenges for people who want to enforce against the third-party providers are certain immunities under the law. There's the Community Decency Act, or CDA, or what some call Section 230, which is meant to exempt websites, web hosts, internet service providers from certain and many types of lawsuits arising from what people upload. And I have seen in the civil arena, as you've seen, people nevertheless try to bring lawsuits against websites that host what the non-consensual porn, third-party providers, and even in one instance, GoDaddy in its capacity as a domain name host, which provided the domain name. Now, under the CDA, for the purposes of third-party providers, many of whom want to do the right thing, and many of them don't. Many of them are scoundrels or they don't care, but might otherwise be compliant with the law or not liable. The CDA provides many challenges. Number one, it's not expertly drafted. It leaves a lot of leeway and a lot of confusion. We don't even know which kind of laws are exempt under the CDA. This is very important to what we're discussing because intellectual property is carved out of the CDA. Intellectual property actions don't apply to the CDA. Now, there's a right of publicity, which many people sue under, is that carved out of the CDA? Is that an intellectual property right? And if I'm drafting a law or if I'm drafting a contract, we would never say intellectual property without specifying what that meant, without defining it. But our legislators, in the infinite wisdom, did not provide that clarity. And there's been a lot of back and forth against that. We don't know now because there are multiple splits. But the other reason it becomes challenging from the third-party perspective is we drafted that with good intentions because I think we envisioned a lot of easy calls, a lot of situations where you are a passive third-party host, like YouTube, for instance, if you believe YouTube or the domain name host, and many situations where you're most definitely not because you are providing the material. The example I often give to people when I first talk to them about the CDA is the New York Times website, because you can use the same exact URL to show you the difference. When the New York Times posts an article, the same thing it would have in print on NewYorkTimes.com, it can be liable for what it prints. It can be, for instance, be sued for defamation arising out of that. The CDA is not, you're online, you get out of jail free. Now, of course, it's subject to all the First Amendment defenses and other defenses, but it can be sued. However, they have a comment section, and the comment section is meant to provide free, full conversation by anybody who wishes to provide information. And if somebody starts talking smack on the comment section of the New York Times, we don't want to hold them liable for that. And the CDA, under the CDA, I think that's your distinction between what is the passive, the comment section of the New York Times versus what the New York Times has provided. The problem with the example that I gave you is that that's fairly easy. And we're seeing a lot of scenarios where they're not so easy, where you have the dirty lawsuit. I'm sure my colleagues are familiar with it. Wasn't necessarily non-consensual porn. What it was somebody whose website is totally devoted to people putting up terrible things about other people, and somebody sued on that. And we have in that scenario a third-party website who doesn't provide the material itself, but to some degree encourages nasty and defamatory material, comments on them, actively selects what you post so that only a fraction of what you submit gets sent to them. And you've seen with there was a court decision finding he could be liable under the CDA, and then that was reversed on the appellate level where he was found he was not. Just because he selects some of the things that you post doesn't make that website the provider. So we're going to continue to see complicated issues and not easy answers with respect to these third-party providers, in part because of a law that is not drafted with any nuance, and in part because the online world will keep on finding new ways to challenge us.
Yep, that's what the internet's for, isn't it? Congresswoman Spire, in her upcoming legislation, is trying to deal with that issue. And she says, for now, obviously we haven't seen the legislation yet, but she says only intermediaries who promote or solicit content that they know violates the statute could be prosecuted. So I think what she's trying to leave room for is the world that Adam mentioned, where we want to encourage people to be able to interact with each other in a way that they have deemed is appropriate for them to do so, even though other people might question their judgment. And we don't want to hold, for example, Tinder or Happn liable if their customers are using their apps to exchange the kinds of images that can be converted into non-consensual pornography. But we do want to get the people who are promoting and profiting from non-consensual postings of these kinds of pictures. Colette, do you feel good about drawing that line in the law?
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt like the target of these laws should be the people who are the bad actors, the perpetrators, as I'll call them. And, you know, I completely echo and agree with what Adam said. I think by having clearer rules and clearer laws and the public better educated, we'll actually create a safer space for the intimate sharing of images that people may want to do in their relationships. And I have no problem. I don't want to be the person who has to, I don't want to be seen as somebody who's saying, oh no, you're not allowed to do that. I mean, that's private space and people need that space. It's really important for human development to know that you can trust and share anything in an intimate setting. So I think if the public, as these issues mature and the public becomes more aware and young people learn and older people understand or whatever.
Right.
I think some of these problems will work themselves out, but I think that having some clarity in the law will signal to people who are building new services and people who are using their services, you know, to be smarter about how they go about engaging in any of these activities. Case law will develop piecemeal, and as Mark described, the Dirty Lawsuit and other ones will chip at or try to chip at different aspects of some of the laws, like the intermediary liability situation for sure. And that is, I think, the nature of how our laws develop and the legal system we have. I think having the new bill that's being discussed and proposed, my understanding, it's been very well vetted, might be not the right word, but a lot of people have looked at it and given the Congresswoman advice on how to approach these issues of overbreadth and vagueness and problems with the First Amendment and problems with making it ultimately an effective bill. So I'm really hopeful that what gets presented is in fact something that both the tech industry will look at without throwing away and saying, oh, this is trying to squelch the internet, and that the people who it's trying to help and the victims and law enforcement will see it as actually providing the kind of ability to go and deal with these things through the criminal justice system in an effective way. One of the problems I have, just not to tangent too far, was there was a law passed in California a couple years ago now. I'm not sure. It was probably in 2012, 2013. And it was a good start at a state law to try and fight the non-consensual pornography problem. But it didn't cover selfies. And it just seemed like a gaping hole to me. It was like, well, this is great. I know it might have been the only law they could have passed. So I'm grateful that they got it in and it got through. And that's an achievement. But it didn't help a big portion of people who are the people the bill or the law was intending to help. So it's sort of a frustrating situation.
Didn't that law get amended though?
I think it has been since. Yeah. Yes. Yes. So, and maybe the legislator,
at the beginning, it was just like they'd completely missed that the problem was not that other people were taking these pictures, but that folks were taking themselves. Yeah.
It can be. It's both. And yes. Maybe the legislators were just smart enough to know we're never going to get the selfie one through. So let's start with the first and then we'll add it. But it having been around the discussion at that time and seeing drafts that had it and then seeing it pulled out, you're like, what are you doing?
Right. Well, one of the criticisms of Representative Spire's proposed IPA law comes from Matt Zimmerman at EFF. And this was a while ago. So I'm not sure if the current iteration of the law still has this problem, but I believe it does. And that is that it only makes certain acts under the proposed law fine. It doesn't enhance the possible civil remedies that people might have under the various other laws that we already mentioned. Adam, do you think that that's a problem in the federal approach?
I do think that's a problem. I think that one of the biggest aspects or the biggest problems with involuntary pornography is that you have all these different laws that might apply to a whole realm of conduct, but you have prosecutors that either do not have the resources or don't care to enforce those laws. So if we add another law and prosecutors are not going to be willing to use that law and are instead going to rely on traditional laws like extortion, so on and so forth, then what's the point? And I think that providing some form of civil remedy would encourage attorneys to take on cases either on a pro or lo bono basis or on a contingency basis, assuming that you know these sociopaths have something to recover on, which they probably don't. But I think giving that kind of tool can't really hurt. So I agree with Matt.
All right. We're going to make getting the sociopaths our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show. If you are listening for continuing legal or other professional education credit, you can demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show if someone needs to have you do that. So getting the sociopaths will be the first one. We're going to talk about trademarking in a what some might think of as a sociopathic way in just a moment here. But first, we're going to thank our first episode for this episode. Our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. And that is Braintree, which is code for easy online payments. If you're a mobile app developer, you've got to check out Braintree. It's the payments solution used by companies like Uber, Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, and Munchery. Braintree scaled with these companies from early stage startups to successful companies they are today. So Braintree can scale with your business too. Braintree has made the payment experiences in these apps seamless and magical, and now you can add a similar experience to your own app. With excellent customer service and simple integration, Braintree gets you ready to receive payments quickly. And Braintree's continuous support plus fast payouts means you'll be prepared as your company grows from your first dollar to your billionth dollar. Braintree is helping solve the problem of mobile cart abandonment by offering a best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Check it out for yourself. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want. And you know there's such a huge variety of options for payment out there. Rather than having to try and identify them and manage them all yourself, you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo cards, and more, all with a single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection too and customer service and, as mentioned, fast payouts. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/Twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. All right. Speaking of sociopathic practices, folks, of course, in the last couple of weeks have had varying reactions and exposure to the killing of Cecil the Lion, various online reactions both to the killing itself, to the doctor who carried out the killing, to other professionals engaged in hunting in Africa. It's been quite a sideshow on the web, or maybe the center stage event, not even a sideshow. But one thing that you might not have paid attention to that Mark has is the trademark ramifications of Cecil the Lion and the fact that some folks, in the light of all this publicity and the notoriety of deceased Cecil, have gone out and begun trademarking in areas for merchandise oriented around Cecil. Can you tell us what's going on there, Mark?
Sure. This is not new, that some people will take advantage of some particular current event or a particular tragedy and find a way to attempt to cash in. And I should put a big stress on the word attempt, because it's not something that is likely to likely to result in any kind of success for the applicant. We saw this with people rushing to the trademark office for Black Lives Matter. We saw it for Hands Up, Don't Shoot. We saw it for I Can't Breathe. You'll go back and you'll find it Charleston Strong. You'll see Boston Strong. You'll see, and you can go back to September 11th. And soon after that, people rushed to the trademark office thinking, I can protect September 11th. It's mine. And we've saw a number of those with Cecil the Lion. In fact, I think sometimes they're doing it just to goad the trademark lawyers. The last one I saw was an application for to register the trademark J. Sweet Cecil in the matter of J. Sweet Charlie, which people tried in the wake of that attack. Most of these people are what I've called trademark gnomes, named after the gnomes in South Park who had a plan to steal underwear and profit from them, but no way of actually, but somewhere in between is how it actually work. This won't work. It won't work for a number of reasons. Number one, you don't get rights just by being the first to get to the trademark office. That's not how trademark law works, particularly in the United States. You have to make a trademark use by actually using the mark in commerce, just by having that right, just by filing it. And many people don't understand this, gets you nothing. And you won't even get it registered. And I think what some people are thinking, if I can be that first one, if I can register it, if I can get it, then anybody who wants else to use Cecil the Lion, anybody else who wants to say Black Lives Matter has got to come to me. And that's my fortune. And it's not going to work. It's going to end in nothing but wasted money for the applicant. In fact, most of these people who try are causing little harm except to themselves in the wasted money that they spent on the applications to register the trademarks, which can be anywhere from $225 to $325 per class of goods, even more if they found a lawyer who's willing to do it for them, which is not usually the case, and they're wasted time. They may also have a plan, well, I'll just put it on bumper stickers, I'll put it on t-shirts, so I will be using it. And that usually is an opportunity that won't work for them as well, because just having a slogan on a t-shirt doesn't necessarily give you trademark rights. You are using it, you are selling something that uses it, but when we see these phrases, when we see I Love Cecil on a t-shirt, when we see Black Lives Matter or I Can't Breathe on a t-shirt, we don't look at that as a designation of source. It's not like a Nike swoosh. We see the item of clothing with a Nike swoosh on it and we know it's a Nike product. We even know, and you can even do that with a slogan, because we know by now when we see Just Do It, it is a Nike product. But they put a lot of time, effort, and money into investing that so that you know Just Do It means a Nike product. You're having a t-shirt with one of these slogans, again, will not have your trademark use. So we see a lot of those. It doesn't cause a lot of damage in the long run to the rest of the world, except that they misunderstand trademarks or trademark law, but they're causing a lot of harm to themselves. And we seem to see this in any single opportunity. Now with Cecil the Lion, however, there's a twist, because one of the applicants to register a trademark for Cecil and Cecil the Lion is Ty, the one who makes the Beanie Babies. So this is a twist, because we can't call them what I typically call a trademark gnome. I can't say they don't have a plan. They do have a plan, and the plan is undoubtedly to sell stuffed animals that look like a lion to the world, which ordinarily they'd be allowed to do. But if they register that trademark, that will prevent other people from calling it, from marketing their own Cecil the Lion. And I think in that scenario, they're still going to have difficulty. First of all, if they care, there's all the negative publicity that arises throughout the world from their trying to make the grab. And I don't think that's mitigated by whatever intention they have to donate to conservation efforts, because we know that even if you have good intentions, we'll see them as wrong or cynical. But if they can get past that, if they really don't mind about that, the problem in that scenario is they're making a false association. They're making a false association with Cecil that they don't really have. And it may very well be, and likely be, that nobody really does have trademark rights to Cecil, in the way that nobody has trademark, really has trademark rights to I Can't Breathe or Black Lives Matter or Boston Strong or Charleston Strong. It doesn't, and we'll never see it like that. I think it's a very curious call. Nobody was
willing to do this, wanted to do this, as far as I can see, when Cecil the Lion was still alive. I'm not sure if it's because many people didn't really know about this famous lion, or because we didn't really think it belonged to them. And I don't think it belongs to them just because the lion is dead now. I should add that when these applications happen, and we see them always, they're predictable. Part of the reason you see them is because there are lawyers like myself and my colleagues who look for them, and we find them, and we post them online, and most of these registrants are subject to a little bit of internet scorn. We'll continue to see these, but they don't get denied quickly because the process of the trademark office is a little slow. For the people who want to oppose the trademarks, for anybody who might have rights to oppose, for instance, the Hebdo Charlie newspaper might actually have had the rights to oppose, the clock doesn't start ticking at the time where somebody applies to register. The clock starts ticking when it's published for opposition, which means it's passed a whole lot of hoops through the trademark office. And many of these won't. Most of these applicants give up.
Right. Suppose you were someone who wanted to make a political statement about hunting. And I see that one of the applicants, the recent rush to the USPTO applicants, wants to do a comic book. Now, they haven't said what kind of comic book they want to do. And I guess they have all kinds of other categories that they've applied in as well, if I'm reading this article correctly. But just taking that example for a moment, not saying that this particular company wants to do this. If you wanted to make some sort of political commentary and maybe, to be a good global citizen, donate some or all of the profits for what you were doing to animal conservation, habitat conservation, or what have you. And you also applied for a trademark. Does that make any difference to the USPTO or not?
I don't, in this scenario, I don't think it would. In other scenarios, it could. I should add that, remember, when you're applying for a trademark, what you're really applying to do is register your trademark. You can have a trademark without it being registered at all, but it's up to you to market that. It's up to you to use it in commerce. It's up to you to show that people associate that phrase, that word, that logo with your goods or your services. And I think that's going to be a very challenging thing to do with Cecil. If somebody really wanted to do that, first of all, they can make the comic book. I'm not sure that there's anything that's going to prevent them from making the comic book. And I already said I'm not sure that anybody actually has trademark rights to Cecil, although I can't be sure about that. So nobody would stop you. It would take your putting that out in commerce in this instance and using it for a long period of time and making a series so that ultimately people do associate that with you. If I could make a comparison to what we call descriptive marks. A descriptive mark is a mark that merely describes what you are doing. It's not arbitrary. It's something that actually is an accurate description of your good and your service. In order for you to actually have trademark protection for something that's descriptive, like American Apparel, you have to put it out in the market first so that ultimately people have seen that enough times that when they see American Apparel, they don't think, oh, this is clothing that's made in America. They think one particular company. They think one particular source. It's more difficult to get a trademark registration for that. You would never get it in what's called an intent to use application, which all of these Cecil the Lion ones are. None of them are using it yet. You would never get it. You would have to put it out in commerce first, which is what American Apparel did. Do the advertising, market, put those stores out there until ultimately you create that association. If somebody really wanted to do that with the Cecil, they could. But again, don't think of the trademark registration as what's going to make you the profit. It's what's going to make you win. In that hypothetical scenario or that actual scenario of the person who wants to make the comic book, even if it's good intention, even if all the money goes to good efforts, the most important thing they need to do is think about how they can make a good comic book that people want.
Right. Adam, any thoughts on this from the speech standpoint? It doesn't sound like a lot of this opportunistic trademarking is much more than a waste of money on the parts of the folks seeking to do it. But I suppose if since things, you never know what's going to happen with the USPTO, if one's issued a trademark and then goes around and tries to squelch other people who are having speech using that mark, it could be problematic.
Well, I don't think anyone's been dumb enough to attempt that yet, which means I haven't learned a whole lot about it and can't really offer much insight on it. But hopefully somebody will someday, just so I have something to write about. I can't imagine that there's somebody that dumb yet. There will be.
All right. Oh, you know, we'll try and live down to your expectations as much as possible. Colette, any thoughts?
Yeah, my only thought is, well, of course, this person can make their comic book, and of course, Ty can make a Beanie Baby if they want, and they can call it whatever they want, but they probably can't call it Cecil. I mean, there's nothing right. holding these companies back from creating a brand and selling their product, and if they want to loosely allude to this horrible tragedy or make it part of the comic book story, I think they can do that. They just have their... I find it really odd that they're trying to protect the trademark in something this way. I mean, I think everything Mark said makes perfect sense. There's nothing holding them back, but this right. is just a waste of their money.
I would add.
Okay, go ahead.
I would add that Ty has done a good job with its own use of branding and its own use of trademarks. We associate Beanie Babies with a particular company. And that's very difficult because they have a particular shape and they're a particular size, and they have a risk that we associate any stuffed animals of that shape and size, even if they're not from the Thai company, as Beanie Babies, what some would call the mark going generic. And they've done a good job in creating that brand. It's up to the public as well. Some people don't understand that. It's what we perceive. Thai has done, through its marketing efforts, through everything else it's done, helping you know what a Beanie Baby is. I think anybody who buys them or is into collecting them knows it's a Thai product or knows it's a product of some company, but they don't want just anything. And in fact, I don't know if this is still popular now, but I used to know adults that collected them and would keep them on high shelves that the children could get to, and they would leave the tag on. What do you see on the tag? It says Thai with the R in the circle, which means a registered trademark, and probably Beanie Babies, which is also a registered trademark, so you see that R in the circle. So this is a company that knows how to effectively brand and generally knows what it's doing when it comes to trademarks.
All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Let's move backwards a moment and follow up on the other part of the discussion about non-consensual pornography. We talked about laws and lawmaking, but there is a practice and policy piece of this too, with a lot of web companies in recent months taking steps to help people pull these kinds of materials, if not off the web, at least out of search results. So let's check in for a moment on the social web. Colette, I just wanted to have you bring our viewers and listeners up to speed on the many fronts where there's been movement in private companies on this, including Microsoft, Google, Reddit, Facebook, Twitter. Basically, you know, the social and search web have all taken on this issue. And first of all, tell us what's happening. And second of all, why is it happening?
Okay. Well, what I see a tremendous amount of activity in the last 12 months on this front, mm-hmm. and kind of ironically that to me that Reddit was the sort of the first. Mm-hmm. But very quickly after Reddit made its initial effort to deal with some of the problems on their site, Twitter came out with their proposals, and I think Facebook was, I can't remember the order anymore, and Facebook was right then. And then in June this summer, I remember this very clearly because it was the week we held our most recent fundraiser for Without My Consent in San Francisco on a Wednesday. And we had a really fun panel. We had Matt Zimmerman, who you mentioned earlier from EFF. He's now at Twitter and actually managing this policy change. So he was on a panel with our co-founder and some other folks talking about you know, law enforcement and what's going on. So that was really fun. That was on a Wednesday. And on Friday morning, kind of out of the blue to all of us, Google did this wonderful announcement of the fact that they were planning to release a portal and a way for people to remove revenge porn and I don't remember. I think they used the word revenge porn, but basically any of those kind of intimate images in their policy. So Amit Singhal made this announcement that you've got on the screen now on their public policy blog. And then a few weeks ago, so that was mid-June, and a few weeks ago, they actually released the portal page where you can submit your information, and then they will deal with having the content taken out of search results. They can't remove it from the web, of course, but they can make it much harder for it to impact your reputation on a search on your name. Very recently also, I can't remember the date exactly, but a few weeks ago as well, around the time the Google form was released, Microsoft also released a process for removing this kind of content from search and from OneDrive and Xbox, I think, or some of the services that Microsoft also offers. So it's been like a momentous year and a momentous like last 2 months, I think, for us. And I'm just super excited that the industry has been doing so much. So why is this happening now? I think there's been pressure for a while, and I think a couple of things have going on in the policy space that has encouraged these changes to finally happen. I really think these firms have been thinking about these issues and trying. There are people inside these companies trying to come up with the right way to do this that doesn't ruin their services and doesn't and permits more people to use their services and feel comfortable using their services and not feel like they're going to run into these problems. So that's one thing. But Kamala Harris, the Attorney General in California, set up a task force this past year that has brought together industry folks, people in law enforcement, people in civil society, like Holly from the CCRI, a few people from my organization have been involved in these discussions and work groups and work streams with like deadlines to like try and make something happen. And I think her shining the light on this cyber exploitation issue has prompted some of these changes. I can't really understand any other reason why they're happening so rapidly now. So that's one important, I think, policy event that has now meted some really interesting and, in my view, positive results. And the other thing I always wonder about, I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts on this, but with the right to be forgotten rulings in Europe, kind of forcing Google to make some big changes in how they handle content online in their search results, they've had to build a system to respond to that. And I wonder now, them and Bing and other search engines, you know, since these systems are now being built to accommodate that European requirement, they can now use them for good and deploy them here in ways that may not be mandated by the law, but is the right thing to do. So that's sort of what I'm thinking on that front.
Yeah, I think there's got to be something to that, Colette, that once you've got streamlined systems in place that work for one purpose, why not repurpose them to do something else that the company deems worthwhile? One reason I wonder if you all think this might be happening at the same time relates to what Mark said earlier about companies needing to get out in front of potential liability issues around this and trying to put as many steps in place as possible to distance themselves from the activities of users. And in Google, in the search scenario, it's not a perfect analogy because the users, I guess, are the web pages that they are crawling and indexing.
So you get to choose.
Right, exactly. But still, I mean, to the extent they can say, hey, we are not promoting or profiting from this kind of material. So that they can show concrete steps that take them out of the kinds of language that liability could attach to. Do you agree, Mark, that might be why we're seeing this kind of move?
I think there is a movement among many companies, certainly the biggest of them, that want to be seen that they do the right thing. So even where they're not legally required to and don't want to be legally required to, or even though they don't enjoy a statutory immunity, which of course the companies would want, they do want to do the right thing. And if they continue to do that, they'll avoid a statutory movement or a legislative movement that would make them liable. So we see that with any of the big respectable companies. I don't think they want to be seen as a party for that kind of thing. But that won't always be the case.
Right. Adam, can I toss this to Adam for a sec? We have to constantly remind listeners and viewers that in order for a speech interest to be impacted, it has to be an act of the federal government that is, or the government, state or federal, that is abridging speech. So when we're talking about private companies deciding what they're going to display and what they're not, it's not technically from a legal standpoint a speech issue. It's more, you know, this is how we're going to operate it. And if you don't like it, set up your own site and do it differently or use another site that does it differently. But with that caveat in mind, since you do pay attention to speech and freedom of expression related issues, do any of these steps that sites are taking give you pause?
In the broadest possible sense, this is a freedom of speech issue. In the same sense that if you invite me into your living room and I start screaming threats about, you know, killing the governor, and then you kick me out, that is also a free speech issue, but it's not a First Amendment issue. Mm-hmm. It does give me pause when companies with as broad a reach as Google and Microsoft say, you know, there are categories of content that we are going to exclude, even when I think it is a good category that we should be getting rid of. So Google, for example, has done this now with involuntary porn and with at least limiting the exposure of mugshot websites. But I do worry if they're, you know, if that could lead not necessarily to a slippery slope, but to other applications as well, which we might not agree with or we might not find as comfortable. But on the other hand, I can't really think of any other applications that they're going to use this for that, you know, we universally aren't comfortable with. So far, I like what Google is doing, as well as Microsoft and other companies. And I think that, you know, if they stay on top of it, if they provide clear and consistent policies, and they provide the resources to be able to allow victims of these sorts of acts to quickly contact them and get content removed, I think it could be a good experiment.
I think actually what you just said there at the end, Adam, is really great. It is an experiment. These companies are trying these things out. They're testing them and seeing what works and what doesn't. Matt Zimmerman even said that at our panel, that while Twitter is doing all of these things, the jury's out on if it's going to work or if they're going to have to change some of the things they did. But I think it's great that they're testing it, you know, just get it out and see if it'll work and see if the sky falls or not. And I think we need to give them a break. All of these companies, to some extent, a little break to try and test it, rather than, I think, you know, victims being upset that it's not broad enough, and, you know, other people being upset that it's too broad.
Right.
I'm glad you said that.
All right. Well, we're going to talk in a moment about Dr. Luke, which I guess will also make our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, and we'll tell you who Dr. Luke is and what litigation is going forward where he is a party in just a moment. But before we do that, we're going to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. It's amazing how many lawyers I know spend way too much time practicing paperwork rather than practicing law. On top of their piles of affidavits and case files, there are billable hours that need tracking, expenses to manage, and client invoices to prepare and send. FreshBooks can make your life a little bit easier on all those fronts. I use FreshBooks in my law practice, and it really makes that end of the month getting bills out something that I don't even really have to give much thought to in some instances, because to the extent I have recurring things that I do for clients, those automatically populate those statements and get approved by me and then go out. And to the extent that I've done non-recurring kind of work, it's very easy to capture that work as it's done, put it right into the spot that it needs to be for the invoice to go out. The invoices look professional. They go out quickly. They get paid very quickly, because there's just something, I think, about getting an invoice in email, which FreshBooks permits you to do, rather than have it come in with the old-fashioned snail mail and sit in an inbox somewhere. I think the turnaround is just much quicker when it's done electronically. If you haven't used FreshBooks before, you need to check it out. It's the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of professionals and lawyers like me the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. It lets you create and send super slick invoices online in minutes. Tracking your time has never been easier. You can also use the mobile app to track your billable hours from anywhere. Plus, FreshBooks mobile apps helps you organize receipts while you're running between the office, a client meeting, and the courthouse. If you do have questions, the award-winning FreshBooks support rock stars are waiting. The real-life person on the other end of the phone, always there to help. So getting started is simple, and it's totally free for 30 days with no obligation. Go to freshbooks.com/twill, and don't forget to enter Twill, T-W-I-L, when they ask how you heard about them. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's break some beats for a moment here on the Hollywood and entertainment front. So we talked a lot on the show about the determination earlier this year and then the amendment of the damages award that involved inspiration of one kind of music being held to actually result in copyright damages. Now we have copyright being applied to percussion. Can you tell us a bit about that? It involves Dr. Luke and a song called Price Tag. And Mark, you've been paying attention to this.
Oh, yes. This is a lawsuit that's going on between the composer of a song by a great 70s Afrocentric R&B group called Black Heat versus Dr. Luke and the other songwriters and producers of a hit song called Price Tag by Jesse J featuring B.O.B. It was a favorite of my son's. And in many ways, this is echoes of Blurred Lines. We have a lawsuit based not on an entire melody being entirely the same and not necessarily on a sample, although it's not very clear from the opinion whether or not that is, but on the rhythm. And in this case, in my view, not as easily noticeable as Blurred Lines, which I have to admit, regardless of what I think about the copyright angle, I heard Blurred Lines and I heard Got to Give It Up, as so many other people did. This, I think, is a little more difficult to hear, but the composer of the song, who has his own publishing company, which sued for it, did hear it. And it's going to cause more fear in songwriters and producers, and particularly hip-hop artists, because they're saying breakbeats. And just to hear that somebody would be suing over similar-sounding breakbeats is going to cause fear and terror.
Right.
And
so
procedurally,
where this stands is one of the parties, I think it was Dr. Luke, who sued for, who brought a summary judgment motion trying to end the case before it ever got to trial. And the judge in the case decided, you know what, I'm not ready to grant a summary judgment here. I think we have to have a trial and the jury's going to have to look at this and see, you know, how close the drum part is going to have to resolve the sampling issue that you mentioned, Mark. It might be fun for our listeners just to play a bit of the Zimbaku original breakbeat and the one at issue in the Price Tag case. So you can see what the court and ultimately a jury will have to make decisions about. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the original. Just the percussion is what's at issue here. And here's the track alleged to be infringing. Thank you, Victor, for that comparison for us. So, I mean, you can see there are similarities and there are very detailed descriptions in the case, and the jury will ultimately hear evidence on the very beat by beat similarities, what, you know, whether there's a drag, whether it's the hi-hat and how much of it is used. And so it gets very detailed. Do you want to try and ballpark this one at all, Mark?
I think it's very scary for the defendants, and they know it's scary because of what happened with Blurred Lines. You already couldn't get past a judge. Many judges are just not willing to decide these on their own. They used to be. I don't know if there's a huge shift with judges, or it just happens to be these two instances and they're well publicized. You already didn't get past there, and expert testimony seems to sway judges a lot. They don't think that they are qualified on their own to determine the similarities. And in this case, that's in part because it's, even if the two songs sound alike, what you're suing on in this case is the compositional elements and not the recording itself, which...
All right.
Judges are convinced that makes it more complicated. I think there's going to be a large incentive to settle because, as we saw in Blurred Lines, where it's resulted in liability that most people didn't expect and millions of dollars in damages that people didn't expect. I don't know if defendants are going to want to roll the dice here.
Right. And it points up once again, as we discussed when the Blurred Lines decisions were coming out, that there's a real need for artists to somehow have certainty that the music they're creating is at least somewhat shielded from this kind of lawsuit. And that's still an open question and becoming, as you point out, Mark, more and more open as these cases continue. Let us end with our tip and resource of the week. We have a couple of resources of the week. The first goes right along with a good deal of our discussion today. And it is a list at endrevengeporn.org of the 25 states that have revenge porn laws, specifically laws tailored to, I think, I haven't looked through all 25, but I think they all impose criminal penalties against folks who engage in the posting of non-consensual pornography. Of course, we already highlighted the without my consent.org list of laws that might be applicable to those sorts of acts as well. So those are a good reference deck if you are looking into what laws exist today and what might be coming when this federal law gets introduced in September. Our other resource of the week is just highlighting for you that Twitter has expanded the scope of its transparency reports. They have two new sections, trademark notices and email privacy practices. So for those looking to get more information about the kinds of requests for information that Twitter fields, you're going to get even more information now in their transparency report. And then finally, our tip of the week is, if you're into having a trial by combat, why not just take a swing and give it a try? This is what a New York attorney has done. He's actually requested a physical fight over a claim that, you know, he deems the arguments against him just ridiculous. So he decided, and this is his own characterization, to come back with a ridiculous response. Although it is grounded in constitutional law, he's making a constitutional argument that trial by combat was once the law of the land, and that our Constitution, when the colonies declared independence from Britain, England at the time, never actually affirmatively outlawed trial by combat. So it should still be an option. So you take a look at this, and if you're into trial by combat, you know, throw it out in your next lawsuit. See what happens. Maybe we'll get a whole movement going, and Game of Thrones type law will prevail in the United States. Of course, I am being tongue in cheek, but I think it's a funny thing to point out. Any panelists' thoughts on trial by combat, and is this just a stunt?
I wonder if the brief was written with feather pen and on parchment paper. That would make me feel really good about the proposal.
Yes, exactly. Anybody else?
I should disclose that the attorney who is becoming notorious for this is our firm's opposing counsel in a completely separate case in New York. He has not, to my knowledge, challenged us to a duel. I suppose it's something we'd consider if it came up. If this is in state court, in federal court, I think it would be a Seventh Amendment issue, but not incorporated against the states. We'll see.
All right. Yeah, let us know, Mark, if he makes that proposal to resolve your case. All right. So this has been a really fun show. We've talked about a lot of wide-ranging topics, bad actors on a number of fronts, but in a good spirited way. And I've really appreciated all of your time and thoughts and insights. Mark Jaffe from Tor Eklund, the law firm. Anything you want to share with us before we go ahead and close the show? Any events coming up at your firm or speaking that you want to share with folks?
Well, I do have to disclose, you said I'm in California, so I'm required to tell you that I just recently moved here. I'm admitted to practice in New York. I just recently took the California bar exam, so I am awaiting admission, and ideally that will be sometime next year, and I'll be the California office of the firm. You see it right there, toreklund.com.
Oh, good. Well, best of luck. We'll keep our fingers crossed as you await your bar results. Adam Steinbaugh, also in California. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you, Adam. Great to virtually meet you on the show. Anything else that you want to let our viewers and listeners know about before we wrap it up?
Well, if you have a problem with involuntary porn and you've been a victim of it, get in touch and either I can help you find an attorney that might be able to help you or I can help you track down the guy that did it or got it.
<Woo-hoo>. Good to know. Thank you so much. And Colette, such a great pleasure to see and chat with you again, withoutmyconsent.org. You just had a successful fundraiser for the organization. Any other ones coming up or anything else you want to let us know about?
For sure. Well, I did mention briefly in passing at the beginning that we just were given a pretty substantial grant to do a bunch more work, which we're thrilled about. But we need actually some help with that. We have a need for some project management on two of the three projects that we're doing. There's a very small amount of budget allocated for that. So if anyone's interested and wants to project manage some work for us, we would love to get more people involved. And we also are looking for more people to help us with the 50-state research. We have some big firms who help us, but we have now committed to finishing that, I think by the end of 2017 or by the summer of 2017. And so we have a lot of work, as you can see, left to do. And we would love people who are interested in excellent researchers to do some of the states that we haven't been able to get to.
Good. And how should people get in touch with you?
They can contact us at founders@withoutmyconsent.com or ping me on Twitter at Vogola.
Isn't it .org?
.org. Sorry. founders@withoutmyconsent.org. Thank you.
You're welcome. And so, thank you so much.
You can contact us on our website. We have a contact form. Yep. You can also use that.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us again, Colette, and to all of our panel. It's been a real pleasure. Great way to spend a Friday morning and into the afternoon here in California. If you have joined us live for the show, that means you have joined us at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when we kick things off every Friday for this show. We love it when you can join us live. But if you can't, go on over to twit.tv/twill, and you'll find our entire archive of shows as well as directions there on how to enjoy them on the device and at the time of your choice. So we're thrilled however you decide to watch and participate in the show. Another way you can participate is by getting in touch with me and my co-host Sarah, who's out this week, but we'll be back next week in our email, which is I'm Denise at twit.tv. She is Sarah P at twit.tv. you can contact either of us via our Twitter pages, or we have a community on Google Plus, a page on Google Plus, and a page on Facebook, which are all great ways to reach out to us and let us know your thoughts about the things we've discussed, things that you'd like to see us cover in the future, guests you'd like to see us have on the show, whatever else is on your mind related to This Week in Law. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. I actually will not see you next week. I'm going to be out next week, but Sarah is going to be helming the ship. So show up and support Sarah. Help her out during the show and IRC. I would greatly appreciate it, and I will see you the week following on This Week in Law. Take care.